It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the House passed the latest bill aimed at dismantling the Affordable Care Act this afternoon. We'll talk to a congressional reporter about the news and what comes next. The House of Representatives voted 217 to 213 this afternoon to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Congressional Republicans have long led the charge to dismantle the signature legislation of the Obama administration. Today, they're one step closer to making this a reality. The bill now heads to the Senate, where it faces an uncertain future.
But while some lawmakers are praising the move to repeal the ACA, some medical organizations and advocacy groups are raising concerns about people with pre-existing conditions.
Kelsey Snell joins us now with the details. She's a reporter for The Washington Post, where she covers Congress. Kelsey, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this thing's been stop and go for a while. What were the key elements of the deal that got Freedom Caucus members, more conservative members, and the more moderate Republicans both to give enough votes to get this through the House?
Well, the thing that kind of brought everyone together was a decision earlier this week to include an extra $8 billion to help fund states with high-risk pools. This came after there was a waiver put in that would allow some states to say that they didn't want to have some of the protections that were included in the Affordable Care Act, like those for pre-existing conditions. If a state applied and got a waiver, then they were kind of in a situation where they didn't have a lot of protections for if somebody got catastrophically sick. So the idea is that this $8 billion was supposed to make people feel more comfortable because it would help offset those costs. In reality, as I've talked to members, I think they felt as much like these new changes helped as they did, as they felt that they just needed to pass something because they've been promising for 7 years that they would be repealing this. And I think there was a little bit of fatigue setting in and a whole lot of pressure from the White House.
Well, this, as you say, has been a goal for a long time now. House Speaker Paul Ryan of Janesville, he's been a big part of this story, of course. Here he is speaking on the House floor today.
What protection is Obamacare if there is no health care plan to purchase in your state? This is the direction Obamacare is rapidly heading. So we can continue with this status quo, or we can put this collapsing law behind us. End this failed experiment. Let's make it easier for people to afford their health insurance. Let's give people more choices and more control over their care. Let's make insurance companies come in and compete for your business. Let's return power from Washington to the states.
So his delegation or his caucus in Congress and the House did ultimately agree with them, it looks like, and voted in favor of this. He made a lot of commitments there. What are people saying about whether it'll meet that goal, making health care more affordable, giving people more choices, and so on?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, medical groups like the AMA and I believe the American Cancer Society, there's a large number of groups that came out in the past several days saying that this would not, in fact, do better to protect people, and that they push instead to make changes and fixes to the law that is in place, because there are, I believe the number now is close to 25 million people who now have care who didn't have it before. And so these medical groups say the best way to get them that care is to fix it. Republicans in Congress say that fixing it isn't an option. And so we're kind of in this impossible situation where neither side is willing to bend. So we are in a place where the Senate will take the House bill, the bill that barely passed the House today, and they will essentially say, that was very nice of you to pass something. Thank you for doing that. And now we're going to start over and do our own version that looks maybe a little bit like what you've already done.
Right. I want to emphasize that point. We're hearing from Republicans in the Senate, not we'll take this House bill and amend it. They're looking to build something new from the ground up. Is that right?
I don't know if they've decided exactly what they're going to do, because I have to say, many of the people, even those people who work closely on healthcare issues in the Senate, many of them felt like they weren't going to engage too much in the House legislation because they weren't entirely certain that the House could pass it. Now that it's passed, they're willing to kind of engage in the conversation, but they didn't want to kind of get themselves in the quagmire that House Speaker Ryan finds himself in, where they have to decide one way or another what they're going to do with a health care bill that really is very unpopular. So the Senate, I think, is probably going to keep some parts of what the House did, but it's entirely possible that they scrap a large portion of it and kind of forge their own path. It's important for people to remember that the Senate and the House are very, very different places. The Senate was created to slow the process down and make it deliberative. That's why you have people who are elected for 6 years instead of two. So they tend to have a longer view on things, and their politics tend to be a little bit more down the middle because they represent whole states instead of tightly drawn congressional districts.
And Republican Lindsey Graham in the Senate said on Twitter today, quoting here, a bill finalized yesterday has not been scored, meaning the Congressional Budget Office. Amendments not allowed in 3 hours final debate should be viewed with caution. That's not a full-throated endorsement by any means.
Right. It's not an endorsement, but it's also not a full rejection. Mm-hmm. He's saying here that he wants to take a look and he wants to slow things down. And I have been talking with people at all levels of Senate Republican staff. Their whole feeling right now is we need to slow it down. We're not going to get around to a vote on this for weeks, if not more than a month. And they want to take their time and do it their own way. We don't know exactly what that will mean, and it will certainly mean something more conservative than what, you know, the Affordable Care Act looks like right now. But it's also important to know whatever passes in the Senate has to go back to the House and has to be reapproved in the House. And there's no guarantee that the House is going to be willing to take whatever the Senate writes. This is by no means the end of the story.
We're talking to Kelsey Snell, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. We're talking about the House passage of a repeal and replace health care bill for the Affordable Care Act. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about today's vote? What do you hope comes next? What do you fear about what might come next? 800-642-1234. Coming up in just a few, we'll talk about some of the political pieces of fallout from this vote.
We're continuing our conversation about the Republican health care bill that passed by a narrow margin in the House today.
Kelsey Snell is with us, congressional reporter at The Washington Post. Go right to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Cindy joins us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, we have a governor in Wisconsin that refused the Medicaid expansion money, so why would anybody think that he'd be willing to put money aside for a high-risk pool of people who are going to be kicked off of the regular health care? I don't understand that.
Cindy, thanks for the call. And Kelsey, as I understand it, the idea is if a state waives that pre-existing condition part of the thing, they would be obliged to set up some sort of high-risk pool. Do I have that right?
Yes, but they cannot just decide to not accept pre-existing
right.
conditions. They have to apply for a waiver and then receive the waiver before they can get to that point.
All right. Thanks for the call, Cindy. And another part of this, and I think this still ended up in there, this law, if it stayed as passed by the House, would take away a lot of the conditions, the things that insurers have to cover under the Affordable Care Act. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. The idea is that conservatives really wanted to make sure that there were no real requirements for insurers, because they say that's what makes insurance expensive, is that insurance became very expensive on the individual market because these companies were being asked to provide things that they didn't provide before. It's because the Affordable Care Act got rid of these plans that essentially they said didn't cover enough and that people were paying for something that didn't constitute true coverage. Conservatives want to go back to a time when people could choose to have a very, very low, it would be a very inexpensive plan, but it would also provide very few services.
I want Kelsey to get into some of the politics here. Now, after this vote, you had, as I understand it, Democrats singing to their Republican colleagues, nah, nah, hey, hey, goodbye, as in this vote is going to lose you a lot of your seats. Republicans carting in Bud Light to celebrate, and then a Rose Garden ceremony, which you usually think of with the president and vice president, which is usually for a bill signing, not for a bill passing a one chamber of commerce. This talk about some of the political aftermath here.
This was all a little bit strange, right? It is a little odd to be celebrating something for passing one chamber of Congress. We don't typically see something like this because, in fact, the work has really just begun. We've only gotten through one very small portion of this. It's unclear to me if they're going to be feeling good about that celebration if this drags on for some time, because if people, when they see celebration, they assume that something will be done and that something is complete. And it's not clear that people understand that, you know, this is a process. And if you wanted to see the Affordable Care Act repealed, it won't be done today. This is not a done deal. For Democrats, they also seem to think that this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to them in terms of running for reelection. They seem to think that this will be the thing that wins them back control of the House and the Senate. I think they may be overstating things because it's not entirely certain that this will be the thing that brings people out to vote. If it looks like it's dragging on and on forever, people won't necessarily feel the urgency. It also may be that they underestimated the number of people who really wanted this law repealed. I think both sides are maybe claiming victory a little bit too soon here.
Back to our callers. Doug is on the line in North Bend. Doug, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you think?
I think that as the commentator just stated that it is early in the process, but that the senators and congressmen need to realize that the normal person who votes for them may not enjoy or appreciate their having Cadillac health care and voting for us to get, call it, bottom of the barrel health care.
Doug, thanks for the call. And Kelsey, that reminds me, this was something that was an issue, and I don't know where this one shook out, the issue of whether or not members of Congress and their staff would be exempted from some of the requirements they're voting on.
Yeah, they said they included a patch to make it so that members of Congress were not exempted, though it's not clear to me how that patch goes forward or how the treatment of congressmen will go forward, because there are specific Senate rules that govern what parts of this bill are even allowed. And many of the things in these most recent amendments are not allowed under Senate rules. They decided to do this repeal and the budget process limit them to only doing things that either deal with taxes or raising and lowering the deficit. They have to make sure that whatever they do doesn't add to the deficit after 10 years. So there's a lot of stuff that the Senate will just have to take out in order to only follow their own rules.
And Kelsey, one big shoe that has not dropped here, this vote came before the Congressional Budget Office scored this plan with its latest amendments. That's still going to happen, right? And people are going to be watching for that eagerly or with fear, I imagine.
Well, yeah, the score is actually a requirement for the Senate process, again, because they decided to do this as part of the budget process. The only way that the Senate can know if, you know, which parts of this bill add or, you know, subtract from the deficit and what it would do over the long term for spending is to wait for that CBO score. The CBO score that will also tell us how many people stand to lose coverage under the Republican plan. And it's expected that a lot of people will be projected to lose coverage under this plan. And that was a fairly damaging part of the process before, though, as we saw, that damage didn't last forever, and they still got a version of their legislation passed.
We'll leave it there. Kelsey, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Kelsey Snell, reporter for The Washington Post, where she covers Congress. She joined us to talk about the Republicans' plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, a House plan passed earlier today.
Coming up after the news, women and girls report higher rates of depression compared with men and boys, according to a new study out of UW-Madison. We'll find out why the rates are higher and at what age girls begin showing symptoms.
And remember, it's our spring membership drive, your chance to help pay for great conversations like this. And remember, there is a dollar-for-dollar match. If you make a contribution right now, boom, it's doubled by anonymous supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio. A great opportunity to support great conversations, to have your support go twice as far. Make that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That's right. Still half an hour to take advantage of this amazing dollar-for-dollar match up to $2,000. Right now, get your pledge doubled. Feel doubly good at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Your You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A new study from UW-Madison has found that rates of depression are significantly higher among women and girls than among men and boys. The study also found that young girls in particular are reporting depression at a younger age than previously thought.
Janet Hyde is with us now. She's a professor of psychology and gender and women's studies at UW-Madison. She was also one of the lead researchers for this study. Janet, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Well, what were you trying to zero in on with this study?
Well, the question we were looking at is the question of gender differences in depression. Many people think that women are the ones who get depressed and men don't. So we wanted to get more complete statistical analyses and also learn what the age patterns are. That is, if women are more depressed, at what age does this gender difference appear?
And so how did you go about getting a good look at that?
Well, we use a statistical technique called meta-analysis. Listeners may have heard of it because it's really kind of become the gold standard in research in psychology and medicine and education. But I'll just explain very briefly. It's a statistical method that allows you to statistically aggregate all of the previous relevant studies on a question. So that's what we did. We looked for very high-quality studies that involved representative national samples from a lot of nations around the world, and then we extracted statistics from those studies and put them together using the techniques of meta-analysis.
So you said countries around the world. How big was this look, and how many countries?
Well, yeah, this was very large. There actually are two meta-analyses. One had about 1.7 million people in it, and the other had about 1.9 million people. And we had over 90 different nations included.
So this was a huge meta-analysis, very wide-reaching. What did you find?
Well, first of all, we did overall, if you average over all ages in all nations, we did find an odds ratio of about 2.0, meaning that about twice as many women as men are depressed. However, and that's important, I mean, that's a major health disparity. However, there are a lot of complexities, so that's really kind of an oversimplification. It varies, that ratio varies a lot with age, and it also varies with nationality. So we wanted to find when this gender difference emerged in development, and we found that it was actually already there by 12 years of age. So already by age 12, girls are more than twice as likely as boys to be depressed. And you get a pretty big ratio, even going up to three times as many girls as boys in adolescents. Then it kind of falls off in the 20s, although there's still more depressed women, but maybe just about 1.8 to 2 times as many. But that age 12 is really cause for concern, because we need to learn what it is that causes girls to be more depressed than boys at such an early age. And that, in turn, will give us clues about how to intervene to prevent this upsurge in girls' depression.
Why was it so important to figure out how early this started?
Well, how early is important for two reasons. It helps us better explain what the causes might be. For example, because it starts at age 12, you wonder if something about puberty has to do with causing the difference, because that's just right in the midst of pubertal development. So one reason is to get a better handle on what causes the gender difference. And then the other reason is it tells you you want to intervene, perhaps with interventions in the schools, because you want to launch those interventions before the gender difference emerges. So you'd want to do it before age 12.
Was this a surprise to you to see that this was happening as early as age 12, when girls are still really in that cusp between childhood and adolescence?
Yes, it was a surprise, and it's new information. Previous studies had found that gender difference emerging a bit later. One of them found it's starting to emerge between 13 and 15 and getting bigger from 16 to 18. But that study was about 20 years old, so some of this may be change over time. So this is an earlier emergence of the gender difference than has previously been known.
Do you have any guesses about whether, you know, it could be that maybe women and girls are better at emotional knowledge about understanding what's going on with themselves? So in other words, it could be more a factor of self-reporting rather than depression per se. Maybe boys aren't as good at knowing how they're feeling.
Yes, that's one point that's often raised, and it has to do with how we measure depression. And I'll explain it for one of the meta-analyses, and that's the one that looked at clinical diagnoses. Now, these were not people who were coming to a psychiatrist or psychologist for a diagnosis. These were representative national samples, and some nations have put a lot of money into this mental health surveillance. So what they do is have experts phone up a nationally representative sample or maybe appear at their door, and they conduct excellent clinical interviews that ask about particular symptoms, and they see if people meet criteria for major depressive disorder. So if these clinical interviews are done right, they should be able to get past what might be a reporting bias in which girls are more willing to report than boys are. I can't guarantee that because boys could withhold information, but a good interviewer should be able to get past that and get accurate information. And that's why we went for these studies with representative samples rather than looking at people who sought therapy or something, because then we do know there's a bias for women to be more willing to seek therapy.
Now, we know that in some cases, issues that affect one particular gender don't receive the same funding or the same attention. Are you worried that the same thing could happen here now that there's this really big meta-analysis that that depression could be pigeonholed as a woman's thing?
I'm very worried about that. So that's a very perceptive comment on your part. Yes, I worry that depression, which is already kind of stereotyped as a female problem, that it'll just get worse, and this is such definitive evidence. The fact is that if it's a 2-to-1 ratio of women to men being depressed, that means about a third of all depressed adults are men, and we can't ignore them. And it's troublesome because once you stereotype a disorder as being for a particular gender only, it can lead to overdiagnosis in that gender. So people might be too ready to diagnose depression in women when maybe that's not what they've got, or they just, you know, they have something much milder. And it could lead to underdiagnosis for men. So therapists might miss men's depression because they think, oh, well, men don't get depression. So that's a very great concern in clinical practice. It also worries me on the research front, because some people do research on adolescent depression and use female-only samples as if girls are the only ones who get depression. But we really need to figure out what's depressing for adolescent boys, too. Their depression may take different forms. You know, if you look at the school shooters, for example, they display a lot of symptoms of depression. So that's, it can be very serious. Boys' depression can be serious. So I don't by any means want to say that depression is a disorder just for girls and women, because it's not.
How much do we know about how boys' depression looks and manifests compared to girls' depression?
Well, different adolescents, for example, manifest depression differently. So it's hard to say typically. We talk about things like blue mood, feeling there's no hope for tomorrow, you know, feeling in a hopeless mood and so on. So boys can show that symptom just as much. But it's also true, especially in adolescence, that a symptom of depression can be irritability. And I don't have solid data on this, but I suspect that the irritability symptom is going to be more common in boys than girls. And the irritability then may turn into something like aggressive behavior. Yes, you might see somewhat different symptoms, and we don't really have good enough data on exactly what the pattern is, but those would just be my inferences.
Now, one thing we haven't talked about yet, and it came as a bit of a surprise, at least to me, was that you found in countries with greater gender equity, the disparity in these rates was even more striking. So what did you see there?
Right, and that was a very surprising finding. So because we had over 90 nations, we were able to do some cross-national analyses, and there are gender equity indicators for each nation around the world that are accumulated by the UN. The UN can give you various indicators, not for all countries, but all participating countries. So we can contrast more gender equitable nations with gender inequitable nations. The U.S. is toward the gender equitable side, although we are not by far the most equitable. There are many Scandinavian nations, for example, that exceed us in equity. And then you'll have nations like Saudi Arabia, for example, that have massive inequity. So what we found was, although this didn't replicate in one analysis, so I don't want to say it definitively, but we did find some evidence that the gender difference is larger in the more equitable nations. Now, why would this be? Because it's counterintuitive. I would have thought women would be doing better in the more equitable nations, but relative to men, they're actually doing worse. There are a couple of possibilities. One is that in the equitable nations, men are more willing to admit their depression, although in some ways that would create a smaller gender gap rather than a larger one. But the leading scientific argument is that it has to do, when you have a subjective thing like depressive symptoms, it has to do with who you compare yourself with and whether you do a within-group comparison, that is, women compare themselves with other women, or you do a between-group comparison, that is, women compare themselves with men. The idea would be in the inequitable countries, men and women are pretty segregated, so women may only be comparing themselves against other women, and they think, oh, I'm doing fine. Whereas in the equitable countries, women compare themselves to men, and they see men not showing these symptoms of depression, and so the women think, oh, gosh, I must be pretty depressed. That's the leading explanation we have, but we need a lot more research about that question.
And Janet, as we go forward, now we have this huge meta-analysis of depression rates. It crosses international boundaries. We know that women are experiencing depression at double the rate of men. What research needs to happen next to fill in the gaps?
Well, we need to know more about the causes of depression, both in men and women. And there's a lot of research in that area. Well, I could tell you 10 different hypotheses, which we don't have time for, but many hypotheses. What we're going to find out eventually is that there are many pathways to depression in adolescence or adulthood. So there's not going to be one particular cause that explains the gender difference or explains all of girls and women's depression. There are probably five different factors I could tell you about. But we need to hone in on those and then figure out what the implications are for interventions, so that we can catch adolescents, especially adolescent girls, but boys too, so that we can catch them before they become depressed and give them coping skills, ways of thinking that will help them combat any tendencies toward depression.
And is this enough to go on, that families and physicians should already start being active and looking for signs when girls and boys are hitting, you know, 11, 12 years old?
Absolutely. They should be asking screening questions in any kind of interview, because the earlier you intervene, even if the person has gotten to a state of diagnosable depression, the earlier you intervene, the better chances for recovery and not having relapses.
Janet, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Okay, I'm glad to do it.
Janet Hyde's a professor of psychology and women's studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she joined us to talk about research she conducted that looks at the rates of depression in women and girls.